We're going to bring the Senate Finance meeting to order. Good morning, everyone. Today is March 18th. Time is 9:05. With us is Co-Chair Kelly, Senator Olson, Senator Huffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop, Vice Chair Senator Fairclough. So we have the full committee with us this morning. This morning we are going to continue our discussion on Senate Bill 108. As well as start Senate Bill 80 and then SJR. What number is that? SJR 16. Okay. And then lastly, we'll get started on the Kinnick Arm Bridge and probably won't finish that, but we'll carry that over till tomorrow. So, is there anything before we get started this morning from the committee members? Okay, seeing none, then let's get started on Senate Bill 108. Yesterday was the first hearing of this particular bill. We had an introduction from the sponsor, Dyson, and we took the public testimony. We have received a new fiscal note from the courts, and I believe we were in the middle of discussing the bill itself. So, Senator Dyson, do you have anything else you wanted to add to Senate Bill 108? Welcome to the committee, by the way, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, and thank you, and Mr. Chairman, and thanks to the committee to both hearing it yesterday and bringing it up today. I've got nothing to add at this point. Glad to contribute to the discussion and answer questions.
Okay. Was there any additional questions on Senate Bill? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Dyson, as we look at the public testimony yesterday, everybody seems to be overwhelmingly in favor of this legislation. Is there anybody that's opposed to it?
Yes, and please understand my remarks are quite respectful. The only active opposition is a gal from the Office of Victims' Rights, and she's a really neat person and really locked in on protecting victims, and she mostly deals with assaults, sexual assaults, and so on and so forth. And she is concerned that the bit of public information that's on court view, that where even where the case is dismissed and so on, build a helpful pattern to be able to see who the bad guys are. Now, what we've done is provide a workaround for through Department of Health and Human Services. So, with training, those folks can get access to what are basically confidential records if this bill passes of people where the case was dismissed or acquitted or found not guilty, that they can get access to those records. A bit of a clumsy one, but it there's, and I'll let Chuck speak to that.
Mr. Kopp, if you could put yourself on the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, through the record, Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Fred Dyson. The exception to access to information made confidential by this bill was brought to us at request of Law, Office of Public Advocacy, and Health and Social Services. They asked that persons who are responsible for the safety and welfare of child placement, vulnerable adults, and seniors with disabilities have access to this information for the placement of those individuals and that work with critical care. Also, the issue was raised that folks that already have access to the state criminal justice information system, which is APSIN, Alaska Public Safety Information Network, that they would continue to have access to this information on court view. With that request, we did have an amendment into the bill, and that is in Section 2 of the bill, which we worked with courts and the affected entities to provide a workaround so they may continue to have access, and that resulted in the fiscal note also from courts.
Okay.
And I might just add that, you know, this is my last session almost undoubtedly, and just a word of counsel to all of you, all of us, that there always be good reasons, good pragmatic reasons to trample on personal liberties and Bill of Rights kinds of stuff. And those are tough calls because you'll hear very heartfelt testimony on why a particular personal liberty is produces some downsides. And that's always an evaluation. From my perspective, we've always got to be very vigilant about restricting civil rights and human rights in contrast to the Bill of Rights. And the default, from my perspective, always should be to take the stand on the side of personal liberties. In this case, it's privacy and due process. And but it is always a temptation to let the pragmatic things overwhelm those liberties. Continual battle, I think, is accelerated in our time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Senator Olson. Additional questions? Seeing none, Senator Fairclough, did you have any comments or concerns? Or you want to pass? Okay. All right. Then if there's nothing else coming for the committee, Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, I move SB 108, titled Limit Public Access to Criminal Records, from the Senate Finance Committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Okay, any objections? Seeing and hearing none, the bill moves out of the committee. Let's just take a brief at ease. We're back. Senator Dyson, you're back with us again with another bill. This is Senate Bill 80. And I know we had some doctors here yesterday who wanted to testify on this, and I apologize we weren't able to get to it. But Senator Dyson, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and then the bill to the committee.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Dyson, Eagle River, Chugiak, Palmer. This is a huge step towards solving one of our perennial problems, and is how do we deliver services, in this case health services, in a very rural state. And as most of you know, for 16 to 18 years I've been here, I was on the Health and Human Services Committee, most of the time as chair of it. And in late 2012, GCI, one of the largest telephone electronic providers in the state, built out a system across the state, and part of what they were doing is they wanted to be able for their employees to be have access to telemedicine, particularly the folks that are remote, and they found out they could not under state law. And that was part of the impetus for this. In our doing research on it, we found out that what most of us think of the Indian Health Service has 240 locations around the state where telehealth is provided for and is up, running, and doing very, very well. And so those folks under that system have access to some remote delivery of health services. And they tell us, and they may testify, that they are easily can quantify $10 million a year they're saving because of people not having to fly to where there's health service available. And We have several other ways that people are wanting to provide this first level of health service around the state, but they are precluded from doing so because of the state law. We've met extensively with the medical board and spirited discussions, and now those folks are on board. And they, of course, control who is licensed, and under this bill, no out-of-state health providers will be able to provide health service by telemedicine in Alaska without having Alaska medical license, and they also will set the regulations for it. This bill carves out that you cannot provide opiates for via telemedicine, a huge issue for most of us, except that now the Department of Corrections wants to be able to do that on an emergency basis when they're dealing with inmates, which is a very controlled environment, who are in crisis or coming down from their addiction and so on. Under existing law, any doctor that was providing medical counsel and services electronically would be in danger of losing their license. When we get this done, because it has to be done, hopefully sooner rather than later, that issue will go away. In your packet should be an article from Alaska Business Monthly that talks about what's going on through the Alaska Native Tribal Health, was it consortium? Yeah, and I misspoke earlier. I now see from my notes that they have this service available in 300 locations. So what happens is that a person with that believes that they have a medical issue, they can link up, and the doctor can do the preliminary screening and so on, and use their judgment of whether indeed the person needs to be transported to where there is more medical services available. I think I've just told you more than I know, and I should turn this over to Chuck. Maybe. Undoubtedly, this will save millions of dollars. I would expect over $10 million for the state. The previous fiscal note you have was based on the out-of-state license, and now that that's been amended out of the bill, that fiscal note is obsolete. We'd hoped that an updated one would be here. You may have received it late yesterday, this morning. We have not. And now I'll turn it over to Chuck Kopp.
Mr. Kopp, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Chuck Kopp. Just to flesh out a few more points said by the bill sponsor, the build-out of the state broadband network in southwest and western Alaska. Interestingly, one of the big recipients of that was the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, which created the Alaska Federal Healthcare Network, the AFCAN network, which expanded telemedicine basically statewide. That does require broadband network. GCI has employees in very remote places, and in order to diagnose, you know, whether it be earaches or throat pain, anything like that, they were using telemedicine. They were given a cease and desist by our medical board because specifically in state regulation, the prescription of medication or diagnosis of a patient must not be done based solely on a patient-supplied history. And for a physician to prescribe a medication, there needs to be an in-person visit. That's based on regulation and unprofessional conduct in Title 12 of the Alaska Administrative Code. So those were regulations that there are some other physicians here that can speak to how Alaska got those. Those are carryovers from the old days before telehealth was really moving. unless you were if you were an Alaska Native or a federal entity, then you had full access to this health care network. But if you were not one of those entities, then you did not. So this bill seeks to allow those people to also take part in the telehealth network. Most of you can get your mind around the idea of a parent with a child with an earache, and you've used aspirin 3 times, but if it doesn't solve it, it's a boat ride down the river or an airplane ride to a hub community with a real medical clinic just to get a proper diagnosis, then possibly a major airplane ride back into town, and then there's food and housing while you're here. So that is why in this article with Alaska Business Monthly, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium did say that in 2013 they saved over $10 million in travel just with their clientele that they serve. The bill before you today introduces into Alaska statutes the practice of telemedicine. As the sponsor said, we met 2 times with the state medical board and had other conversations. Additionally, we worked with the state medical association to come to the language that we're at today. We more recently came upon the need from the Department of Corrections to have an exception to be able to allow them to continue to prescribe controlled substances electronically, and that's due to their diverseness, 37 jails and prisons in very diverse geographic locations around Alaska, bringing in people who are in custody, who may be going through withdrawals, delirium tremens, they may have severe behavioral disorders, they need to be stabilized right away, and for them to be able to maybe flown from that jail or brought to a hospital would be enormously expensive to DOC, and they have a physician and medical director that can speak better to that here, and we are certainly very supportive of that exception. Our bill briefly brings us into line with 13 other states that do allow for physical examination to take place electronically. Those are California, Kansas, Maryland, New Mexico, Ohio, Texas, Vermont, Hawaii, Louisiana, Nevada, North Carolina, South Dakota, and Virginia. We did remove the original out-of-state licensing program, and that was as a result of a lot of dialogue with the board wanting to take this in baby steps as we roll it out. And that would also explain why we use Section 1 of the bill, the practice of telemedicine, as a widely recognized definition for what telemedicine is, and it's there before you. Section 2, when we get into prescription of drugs without physical examination, this was the highest standard of care that both the board and the medical association felt good about rolling out, involving physicians, and that the prescription drugs not be a controlled substance because of the potential for abuse, and that the physician be located in the state, because it is possible to be licensed and practicing in Alaska, but to do that all from Florida. They wanted the physician to be located in the state, which assumes that you're also licensed, but they wanted that physician to be available for follow-up care. That's why the language before you has that. The third qualifier is that the person consents to sending a copy of the records of the encounter to their primary care provider if the physician that is prescribing the medication is not their primary care provider, and the physician sends the records to the person's primary care provider. Definitions are provided for controlled substance, prescription drug, and primary care provider. What we do want to also state on the record is while the language says the board may not impose disciplinary sanctions on a physician for adhering to this standard of care, it is not our intent that the board will impose disciplinary sanctions if an entity does not, because we recognize the board's authority to make exceptions, which they already do for good reason in regulation. They make exceptions for emergency treatment. They make exceptions for public health emergencies, for any act of bioterrorism, for expedited partner therapy, for sexually transmitted disease investigation and treatment. So the board already has regulation or has authority to make exceptions to a general rule. So the general rule is high, it's a high standard of care, but it is our intent that the board would make exceptions to that as needed, and certainly Department of Corrections is one of those entities. The bill concludes with Section 4, which deals with health insurance, and this was worked on with insurance providers that provide telehealth. We made sure there was no mandate that insurance is provided, but it says basically if you do provide coverage for telemedicine, that you will not require that prior in-person contact occur between a healthcare provider and a patient before payment is made for covered services. Basically, that's just a parity law so that discrimination is not made between in-person and electronic visits. And we have a representative from Pumera Blue Cross that can also speak to that online. And that concludes my remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Cobb and Senator Dyson. Questions? I think I'm going to look at Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at page 2, Mr. Cobb, or I'm assuming you're the one that's most familiar with it, where it talks about the physician being located within the state of Alaska before, as you look at, go back to section 2, the first part of it there, where it's talking about prescribing medication. What's the reason for the physician being located within the state?
Physician located in the state would be the physician practicing telemedicine. So if you were at your home office and you had, let's say, a patient downriver from you, that you are a physician located in the state and you're practicing telemedicine, and you are available then for follow-up care if you need to go to wherever that person is. It just addresses that.
Wait, continue,
Mr. Chairman. Yes, please.
So if I'm on vacation down in California visiting my relatives and I've got a hookup with my cell phone or some other type of electronic device to go ahead and treat patients up in Shungnak or Savunga, it sounds like you're prohibiting me from doing that. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the medical regulation already provides exception for existing physician-patient relationships. If it's your patient and that is your relationship you've established, you can continue to do that. And I'm sure that someone here will correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe I'm right on that. That any existing patient of yours, if that physician-patient relationship exists, there's no problem with that.
The problem that I see is that that's not what Section 2 addresses. Section 2 addresses prescribing medication without a physical examination.
But if it is your patient, you already have that relationship. This would assume right here that for a person that's in state, not out of state, but in Alaska, prescribing medication, that can happen as long as they adhere to the standard of care laid out in the bill. Your example being out of state to treat one of your patients, there's an exception in regulation for that.
Senator Dyson, the medical board, as you would understand, are pretty conservative, and there was some resistance to messing at all with traditional doctor-patient relationships, and they and I had some reservation about some very large firms that are doing this nationally, and they have all of their doctors are out of state and dealing with it. And the medical board really wanted to restrict this to doctors who are licensed here in this state and are residents in order to both preserve that traditional doctor-patient relationship and to have some of our medical care transferred to doctors and firms that are never here.
Mr. Chairman, maybe what I really should have started out doing was, as you look at the bill, apparently the Alaska Medical Association isn't in support of that bill. Is that correct?
I believe they are at least neutral now, and they may be supportive. Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the part they did not support was the out-of-state licensing of physicians, which this bill used to be about 4 pages long that had an out-of-state licensing program, and they asked us to pull that out, and we did and kept it all in-state.
And so that's the medical association. What about the Alaska State Medical Board that is obviously under the direction of the Occupational Licensing Division of the Commerce Department? Do they have a position on this?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, so that was the medical board that asked us to pull that out, and we did. We have been also working with the medical association, and I think they have a representative here, and my understanding is they are in complete support of this.
So I'm confused. First you talked about the medical board, then you say no, it wasn't the medical board, it was the medical association.
No.
Let's start off with one thing for sure. Mm-hmm. The Alaska Medical Association, which is a private professional group, what is their position on this on this bill?
Our understanding is they are in support of this bill.
Let's go back to the medical board now, which is appointed by the governor, is under the Division of Occupational Licensing, under the Department of Commerce. What is their position on this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, our belief is that they are in support, or they are at least neutral, but not opposing the bill.
Okay, that's, I guess, that now I'm straightening on who's there and who isn't there. Have you talked much to the rural providers out in rural Alaska to see how they are viewing this bill? And I'm not talking about, let's start off with the Indian Health Facilities, the 638 contractors. What is their position on the bill?
Senator
Dyson, go ahead. If you guys could go through the chair so we can have
the
whole committee participate.
Chair, Senator Dyson. I think they're very enthusiastic and have built out an amazing system. And my experience and what I think that they implied is that they will tend to treat anybody in the area, but indeed treating people who do not qualify as Alaska Native is problematic under existing regulation, and they are glad to have this change for that. But you'll be very impressed with what they've done.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead, please.
Continue. That's the IHS 638 contractors who get federal funds, so they certainly have to go ahead and treat everybody that comes through their door because of the funding that they get. But there are people out in rural Alaska that are actually private. Now, there aren't very many of them, people in private practice, people, physicians who are on contract to the hospital that are indeed treating patients out there. Have they put in a position on this bill?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, we have not received a position statement from that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I appreciate the comments, Senator Olson and Senator Dyson. We do have several people who want to testify, and perhaps some of the questions that you asked will be answered through the testimony. There is not much in the file, though, as far as people supporting or against it. So when that happens, we tend to believe that everyone's neutral. So if there is somebody who's opposing this, some association, medical association or something, hopefully they'll speak up. Additional questions? Okay. Senator Dunleavy, I think you heard this bill in Labor and Commerce. Have we covered the concerns that you had in Labor and Commerce?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Okay. Then let's go on then to, before you leave, did you mention there is a new fiscal note coming? Because the one we have now is $300,000, I believe.
To the chair. Yes, that fiscal note is not valid. We have brought that to the attention of the various entities that issue fiscal notes. They agree with us. It's our understanding that a zero fiscal note has been signed off on. We have not seen it yet. But everything in that fiscal note pertains to what has been removed from this bill.
Okay. And we have not seen it yet either. And I understand that corrections still has some concerns or some comments they want to make, and I think that's one of the groups we're going to hear from here this morning. So maybe they'll address the fiscal note. Okay, very good. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay, let's hear in Juneau, if you're here for questions or if you want to testify, just let me know. Laura Brooks with the Corrections, Department of Corrections. Okay, good. You were able to make it back again, Bob. That's great. Sorry about not getting to you yesterday. Okay, if you could put your name on the record for us.
Thank you. My name is Laura Brooks, and I'm the healthcare administrator for the Department of Corrections.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairman. Robert Lawrence, board certified family physician here in the state, chief medical officer for the Department of Corrections Inmate Health.
Excellent. Do you folks have any comments on the bill itself or any concerns?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, we do. Thank you for hearing from the department. We have been working with Senator Dyson's office on some of the wording here. The Department of Corrections was actually one of the first agencies to start using telemedicine in order to provide improved medical services to our inmates across the state. Our psychiatrists started using telemedicine or telepsychiatry back in 1998. And doing this has really allowed us to defer some significant costs that would have been incurred had we had to staff those facilities with psychiatrists. Previous to the telemedicine, we were actually sending our psychiatrists out to our 13 facilities several times a month. And so once we started using telemedicine, it became a very efficient way for us to provide medical services to our inmate patient population. The telemedicine has really become a very integral part of what we do every day. And the wording related to controlled substances is really where it could impact the Department of Corrections in a couple of areas. As I mentioned, our psychiatrists prescribe controlled substances for new arrests who come in with a current prescription and for those experiencing mental health crises. And we do that on a fairly regular basis. The telepsychiatry allows us to provide that safe and immediate intervention for those inmates who are experiencing a mental health crisis without us having to send them to the local hospital or bring them into Anchorage for treatment. And as you know, Department of Corrections is a 24-hour provider. We never close. And so what we have on our inmate health side, our medical side of things, is a 24-hour on-call system where we have a mid-level provider or a physician who's always on call because we can't possibly staff all of our facilities 24 hours a day. And so prescribing controlled substances is actually quite common for those providers because the vast majority of our highly intoxicated arrestees come in after hours. And many of those arrestees are at high risk for alcohol withdrawal, which can, of course, be life-threatening. So we estimate approximately 3,000 of those controlled substance prescriptions are written every year just for that segment of our inmate population. And so although DOC doesn't have any policy concerns with this bill, again, we greatly appreciate Senator Dyson and his office being willing to work with us on the wording so that we can continue to practice and provide those services as we have been since 1998. Dr. Lawrence, I believe, has some additional comments.
That's right. Thank you, Chair. Robert Lawrence, the Department of Corrections. I think it's helpful to clarify that there are different types of telemedicine that are currently in use in the state of Alaska. We use that term interchangeably, and I believe a misunderstanding of those different types leads to confusion regarding this particular bill. The first type of telemedicine, as Ms. Brooks alludes to, that has been in use for many years, well over a decade, is what we would call provider-to-provider communication, where one doctor consults another doctor, a nurse may consult a doctor, a health aide may call in to his or her provider. And that is what's used by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, all of our IHS facilities. That's what's been used by the Department of Corrections. The second level of telemedicine is a direct patient-to-provider communication, which was alluded to earlier, I believe, by Senator Olson, who asked the question, what happens when a patient wants to contact his or her provider? Both of those forms of telemedicine are fully approved, as I understand it, by the state medical board. The third type of telemedicine, and the one that is being addressed by this legislation, is a form of telemedicine where a patient is able to contact a director medical provider directly without the existence of a prior doctor-patient relationship. The position of the Department of Corrections is simply a request, and we appreciate the sponsors of the bill working with us to ensure that as we move forward with this new type of telemedicine, that we don't negatively impact the way telemedicine has been practiced and is already approved in the state. So one brief example, just to show the importance of this, sometime today I may be called by one of our rural facilities. A nurse will tell me that we have an inmate who's been admitted overnight, now showing signs of withdrawals, which would lead to seizures, possibly delirium tremens, which would be life-threatening. I can prescribe for them a benzodiazepine and stop that entire process. By doing so, we've save the patient's life and save the state a tremendous amount of money that would have been spent taking them to an emergency room. The problem is that that medicine is a controlled substance, and there was not a physical exam by myself that led to that prescription, which is why we asked for the exception in this rule to say that a controlled substance can be prescribed, as long as that controlled substance is being administered by a healthcare professional on the other end of the transaction. And you'll see that in the amended language, I believe, of this legislation. So I remain open to questions that you may have regarding our position.
Okay. It's my understanding we don't have that amended language yet.
Is
that
I apologize for misspeaking, Chairman. The I simply mention that to say that we're working with the sponsors of the bill on coming up with language that accommodates the forms of telemedicine that are currently in practice at this time.
Excellent, excellent. Okay. And then there is not a fiscal note either from corrections. Is there going to be a cost to corrections after the amended language, I guess?
Mr. Chairman, after the amended language, we anticipate being able to continue our practice as we've been doing, so we don't anticipate with that change any fiscal note.
Okay. Oh, very good. Then we'll look forward to that amended language from the sponsor and come back with the committee substitute. Additional questions for corrections, Dr. Lawrence? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure who to go ahead and prescribe this to, but maybe Dr. Lawrence is probably the best one. On the bottom of page 1, line 14, it says the prescription drug is not a controlled substance. I guess where I'm coming from is, as you look at physicians who have a license to go ahead and practice medicine, that's one of the most valuable pieces of paper that a person gets after they've gone through all the schooling, and so there's a fair amount of money invested in that, and anything that jeopardizes the validity of that by either some type of regulatory action from the licensing division, which puts it there, and the concept is that you want to stay out of the gray areas. You want things fairly well defined so that you know, yes, you're on the right side of the law, no, you're not on the right side of the law. And so isn't that kind of what we're trying to go through? Is that kind of the starting point that we're at? And here's where I'm going with this. Instead of having controlled substance as the verbiage states there, why not put some type of FDA type of designation on there, like Schedule 1 or 2 drugs that are out there, and specifically have that there, as opposed to, you know, a controlled substance to most people, just a prescription medication.
Through the Chair, Senator Olson, I, both as a practicing physician in the state and as the Chief Medical Officer for the Department of Corrections, I think I can say that I believe the concern in this legislation, the reason that line, as you mentioned, line 14, is here, is out of concern that someone would maliciously use telemedicine to prescribe a narcotic or other controlled substance based solely on an internet contact or, you know, being called by someone without this doctor-patient relationship being established. As you well know, the FDA gives us different levels for the prescription of controlled substances. Some of those cannot be prescribed over telemedicine regardless of whether or not it's allowed by state law. That would be the Schedule 1 and 2s. They require a wet sign prescribed prescription. But the other scheduled medicines are just as equally problematic in our small communities because of the potential for abuse. And so there needs to be protections legislatively or restrictions on the prescription of those medications without a prior doctor-patient relationship, so that both sides of that transaction trust each other and know how that medicine is being used. And I believe that's why this particular line was included, was to protect the state and our communities against the malicious use of telemedicine in that way. That being said, there are very legitimate reasons for the prescription of controlled substances. I alluded to one of those earlier. Telepsychiatry is another way that we are required to use that. And so we don't want the language in this legislation to prevent those legitimate uses of telemedicine. The example that you just used may be a way of addressing that issue by delineating which level of controlled substance that's being addressed.
Senator Olson?
My other question has to do with, it talks about a person consents to sending a copy of all the records to the person's primary care provider. Out in rural Alaska, some people don't even have that, whether they're beneficiaries or non-beneficiaries. And so how do you see that as causing a problem, or is there a problem with that where they don't have a primary physician that they can send their records to?
Through the Chair, Senator Olson, in the Department of Corrections, it is not an issue at all, because obviously inmates are not contacting me directly, and their primary care provider is not of concern when we're doing our evaluations or prescriptions. I can't exactly speak to how other physicians in the state would respond to that. Obviously, the lack of a doctor-patient relationship is one of the major problems that we are chewing on. As Senator Dyson mentioned earlier, trying to reduce that distance between patients and providers and even making sure that patients have access to a provider is one of the perennial problems of our time.
I guess what, Mr. Chairman, if I continue, I guess what I'm trying to address is those people that are out there that aren't, don't have the umbrella of being either covered by federal tort or by some type of state institution that provides them protection, where you're just a solo practitioner out there trying to make a living and trying to provide health care. That's the kind of person that I'm trying to go ahead and make sure that we as bureaucrats don't step in his way and inadvertently get him in trouble with his license.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Olson, speaking more as a as a physician in the state, I fully recognize that there is fear that the use of telemedicine may hamper the business side of practices throughout the state. I think that what we find in the limited amount of research that has been done thus far on telemedicine is that telemedicine does not harm anyone's practice. If anything, it helps to feed it, because telemedicine is not intended to take the place of the doctor-patient relationship. It actually enhances it. It in some way makes it more robust. And what we find in rural Alaska is that if patients are able to connect with a personal physician, then they're more likely to go to that physician more often when they have a concern or a problem. I don't know what the answer is to the problem of a patient connecting with a provider with whom they have no relationship and also do not have a primary care provider to whom that telemedicine consult can be sent. I don't know what the answer to that will be. I don't know that that negatively hampers the doctor-patient relationships that have already been established, though, throughout the state.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Thank you, Senator Olson. Additional questions for Dr. Lawrence or Department of Corrections? Seeing none, thank you very much. By the way, we do have that language that you're talking about, that amended language, and my staff's been working with the sponsor staff, so we'll bring forward a CS shortly on with that language in it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, now again, I don't know if you're here for questions or if you wanted to testify. Sarah Chambers, questions it looks like only. If I'm wrong, come on up. And then Sandra Garcia Align. All right, then if you guys change your mind, let me know. Otherwise, I'm going to go off net here. Dr. Powers in Dillingham with the Bristol Bay Health.
Good morning, this is Dr. Dave Powers.
Okay, good morning, Dr. Powers. You want to testify on Senate Bill 80, correct?
Yes, Chairman, members of the committee.
Go ahead, please.
I'd like to say I appreciate you hearing my comments. I'm a physician in Dillingham, Alaska, and also a member of the State Medical Board. So I do have a few comments I'd like to make regarding this bill, and hopefully I will clear the water and not muddy it further.
Okay.
But first I would like to speak about what exists, the state of affairs in rural Alaska, from my perspective. When I came to Alaska in 1984, I worked in Anchorage for a couple of years, and I was told, as I looked at the map and the vast geographical area, that nearly every one of those little villages, there was a health aide. There was somebody there to provide medical care. And then later, as I went to work in Barrow, and I went to work in Bethel and Dillingham, and in St. Paul Island and Southeast, that was true. It was amazing to me that there was better health care access in rural Alaska than there was in rural Colorado, where I grew up, or in rural Idaho, where I'd worked a couple years before. As Alaska was way ahead of the rest of the United States in being able to provide health care at a distance. So, with regard to telemedicine, we got the AFCAN set up in about 1998, and that rapidly became something that we relied upon. We use it a lot. And that's in every one of our 28 villages. And we have both store and floor. We can look at pictures. We can look at EKGs. We can do video teleconferencing. And practically speaking, no one is restricted from using that. If you're in a village, it doesn't matter if you're native or white, you can go to the clinic and be seen. I'm not sure if that's the case in every other Bush hospital, but at least when I worked there, it was. That's been years ago. I've been at Dillingham for the last 20 years. So the current state regs and how we interact with those with regard to telemedicine, I have a health aide on the other end of the line. And so that's part of my team. I have a provider there. So it does not break the law with regarding to a patient, patient-only history. I have someone that can take vital signs, that's examining the patient. It gives me information that I wouldn't get just from the patient themselves. So that's an essential part of what we do. When I look at this bill, and this, you know, I haven't heard the amended wordage, but on number one, the prescription drug is not a controlled substance. And let me say that this bill does not say, except for the exceptions already in regulation. So if you were just reading this bill for the first time, you wouldn't know that, you know, it was okay to do what we're already doing. When I looked at this the first time, it, you know, it kind of made me panic a little bit because it suddenly made everything that we've been doing for years illegal. I guess from what I've heard this morning, that is not the case. It's not a problem. So with regard to number two, the physician is located in the state. And this has been brought up as well. We're not so concerned whether or not the physician is physically located in the state. I was in San Diego last week at a palliative care conference, and I got calls every day from a little village, talked to the health aide, and could solve problems because I know those people. That's my village. They have my cell phone number. But what this says is that I couldn't do that. It's suddenly illegal. Unless, you know, there's an exception to that, which I guess there is. The next part of number two there, available to provide follow-up care. So this for me is sort of a quandary in that if I'm talking to someone in rural Alaska, does that mean I'm available to provide care via telephone? Does it mean that I'm going to suggest they come and see me in my office, wherever I am? I'm not sure how to interpret that or how that's useful. I guess in conclusion, I'd like to say that we have discussed this at the State Medical Board at length. And so let me just read to you what the law now says and then the exceptions that we've made. And this is from AS 80.64. Unprofessional conduct includes the following: providing treatment, rendering a diagnosis, or prescribing medications based solely on a patient-supplied history that a physician licensed in this state received by telephone, facsimile, or electric format. And these are new. These are proposed changes, except for mental health care, reading films by a radiologist or samples or photographs by a pathologist or a dermatologist. C, caring for a patient in a community where there's no physician, physician assistant, nurse practitioner, or community health aide to conduct a physical exam. That is, we are not against this telemedicine at all. We view this as a tremendous asset that's most effectively and appropriately used with a provider at each end. But we recognize there are settings in the state where that's not possible, and we just need to do the best we can with what we have. So to that end, we have made an exception for people that live in a community where there is no provider. They can use telemedicine. I can't really speak to the non-rural use of telemedicine just because that's not my area of expertise and I haven't worked there, but I feel like I've been in the Bush, Alaska long enough to make a fairly well-informed statement on that. I guess that's all I have to say.
Well, I appreciate the testimony, Dr. Powers. So does the state medical board then support this bill? I wasn't sure. Maybe you said it and I just missed it.
I think with regard to this bill, what I've read about the sponsorship of this bill is primarily aimed at people in rural Alaska that have no access to health care. And to that I would say two things. Number one, the Afghan system that's in place is almost everywhere in rural Alaska right now, and there are no restrictions for non-natives to use that system. Anyone that's out there can go there and be seen by the health aid. That is, our health aides won't refuse to see anyone, regardless of whether they're Alaska Native or not. In the few places that remain, where there's no telehealth, where there's no physician, where there's no mid-level, no health aid, we're making an exception that you can have a doctor-patient interaction with a patient-supplied history, and you can practice telehealth medicine in that setting.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you, Dr. Powers. Senator Olson, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Powers, as I look to you for your position as a medical board person who has the ability to go and take action on somebody's medical license to go to the far extent of suspending and revoking it, does this legislation clear up the boundaries of the practice of medicine so they're more clearly defined and not so many gray areas out there, or what does it do to the whole area that people feel uncomfortable about telemedicine and the possibility of having an investigation done on their license?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, this legislation for me did not clarify telemedicine. It did the opposite. It raised questions and gave me more concerns than it did clarify things. To that end, we made the exceptions that I just mentioned.
Mr. Chairman, it might be to our advantage to have him take a look at the new CS to make sure that that is indeed the case, because I'd hate for him to be making an opinion that represents the medical board that may indeed be adverse to the bill's passage and certainly the sponsor.
I agree.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I agree, Senator Olson. I think some of the concerns that are being raised will be addressed in the new language in the CS. In which case, then, if after Dr. Power sees that, if he has some additional comments, that would we'd certainly like to hear it. So let's move on. Thank you, Dr. Powers. I have some folks, and I'm not sure again if you wanted to testify or if you're for questions. There's a Dr. Henry Phillips in Nashville with the Teladoc. And sir,
yes, sir.
Yeah. Did you have any comments, or were you just online for questions?
My original intent was to be available for questions, but at the chairman's discretion, I'm happy to make a couple of comments, if that's okay.
Sure. Go ahead. If you could be fairly brief, because we're under a time constraint. But go ahead, Dr. Phillips.
Absolutely, and I appreciate the time. So Dr. Henry DeFillips, I'm the corporate chief medical officer for a telehealth company known as Teladoc, for a 12-year-old company, the largest in all of the United States by any measure. And we have coming up on 500,000 consults with a perfect safety record, i.e. no liability issues in the history of the company. So it was very interesting hearing Dr. Powers' testimony, and I'm very appreciative to hear that. I also have a brother-in-law who's been an emergency room physician throughout the state for the last 16 years and have traveled to the state both for business and pleasure extensively over that time. So I certainly understand. The medical board has actually taken action against physicians in our program and other companies like ours programs and either threatened or really pulled licenses. So I think in the actions speak louder than words department, the reality is that the medical board, and I don't know what Dr. Powers' role, if any, was in any of those actions, but the medical board has spoken pretty clearly with their actions that they're against telehealth, at least in certain circumstances. The telehealth industry really boils down to this. There's probably about 15 million Americans across all 50 states that are in a telehealth program today, and that probably will double in the next 12 to 18 months. So it's becoming real. It's becoming much more common. it definitely, telehealth does definitely help solve a rural access issue. And even with Dr. Power's comments, you probably heard, if you listen carefully, that someone in a rural area in Alaska still has to travel to where there is a health aid in order to participate in a currently legal telehealth program. What the bill that's currently on the table does is it allows somebody to stay in their location, whether it's at their office, their home, their farm, wherever they happen to be, in contact a physician in one of the telehealth programs that they do not have a previous relationship with, without having to travel to a location where there is a health aid present. Interestingly enough, about 50% of the utilization tends to be rural access. The other 50%, I'm just going to be very candid with the group, happens to be in urban settings. So in the city of Anchorage, if you have sinusitis and you call your own primary care physician, which everybody endorses is the first response that you should have, and you attempt to get an appointment, sometimes that appointment will be 3 or 4 days down the road, or if it's sooner, it might be with a nurse practitioner or physician assistant. Even in urban settings, my point is that it is difficult for very common, very uncomplicated medical problems to access your own primary care physician timely in the time frame that you like. And so what this bill does is it takes all of the current telehealth variants that exist in the state of Alaska and extends them all one step further so that a patient can contact a physician who's credentialed and qualified, and hope preferably, certainly has an Alaska license, but preferably is resident in Alaska. And we would love to continue to build out a network of Alaska physicians, but we need regulatory cover in order to do that. In other words, these docs need to not be concerned about having their license pulled. And that really is what this bill is about.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the those comments, Dr. DePhillips. Questions? Seeing none at this time. So let me go on now to Sheila Tallman in Seattle with the Premier Blue Cross. Did you want to testify, or were you available for questions?
Hello, I was just going to be here and available for questions, if there are any.
All right, thank you, Sheila. We have a question for you. Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sheila, if you could, you describe to me how someone calling in from rural or urban Alaska, how the insurance would be handled for that person when they don't have a physical appointment with a doctor?
Sure. Right now, I know telemedicine services are being provided in our markets in Washington and possibly Alaska. I think we're actually only aware of it if the provider is using a modifier when the claim is submitted. So if that modifier is submitted, that kind of indicates the delivery mode of telemedicine, and so that would be the way that we are aware of the service. Am I answering your question?
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You're providing me additional information. What I'm wondering is if insurance companies cover telemedicine. I guess that's a better way to put it.
Oh, yes. Yes, and Premera does cover telemedicine services. What the general kind of language is that as long as the service was covered under the policy already, then it is very likely that it will be covered via telemedicine. I'm not aware of any general exceptions at this time, but and just at a very high level to say that the service, if it's covered under the policy and under the contract, then it is likely covered under telemedicine. And I know in Washington State, it really does depend on whether the provider is including the modifier when the claim is being submitted. So sometimes we're not actually even aware that a service might be provided via telemedicine. I think that's rare, but it is something that could happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, Sheila, for answering the questions. Okay, Ron Hale in Anchorage with the Hospital Administration, Alaska Psychiatric Insurance. Were you available? Did you have a question? Want to testify, or are you available for questions?
Well, I'm available for questions, and I'm at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute.
Ah, very good. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Was there anyone else who wanted to testify, either here in Juneau or online? Okay, then we are going to...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator?
I do have a question for Mr. Hale.
Okay, I'm going to close public testimony then, but you can certainly ask questions to anyone. So public testimony is closed. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hale, as the administrator for EPI, which is a state institution, what do you have an opinion on the bill? Will this help? Are you neutral, or will this in some way inhibit your ability to go and provide mental health health care to the rest of the state of Alaska?
Well, Senator, also through the chair, I hate to provide an opinion. I don't think I'm allowed to do that as a state employee. My own opinion, but I think we need to work with the sponsor on the bill. I think we can make it a better bill if we do that. I think we are working with the sponsor through through our legislative aid, the department's legislative aid.
Mr. Chairman, one additional question. Mr. Hale, as you look at, there's a new committee substitute that was just handed to us, and I'm assuming you don't have it. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true, sir. I don't have it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Yes, I don't think the committee members have the new committee substitute yet. We wanted to hear the comments today and then bring forward something tomorrow or the next day. And again, we're working closely with the sponsor. So if there's no additional questions or comments, I think at this point in time, we should just hold this bill over until we get the new committee substitute. Hopefully we'll address some of the concerns that we've heard today. So with that, we'll set this bill aside until the new committee substitute comes. Senator Dyson, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Okay, we'll take a brief at ease while the presenters get ready for the next bill, which is a Senate Resolution 16. Okay, we're going to bring Senate Finance back to order. Next item up is Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 16, which pertains to coal resources. And this is Senator Kelly's resolution. Senator Kelly, are you going to introduce the bill or your staff?
I'll go ahead and do that, Mr.
Okay, Senator, Senator Kelly, then the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Joint Resolution, excuse me, Senate Concurrent Resolution 16 recognizes a couple things about our energy problems in the state. One of them is that our energy portfolio has not been diversified. In the lower 48, you have a mixture of about 35 to 50% coal. Then there's the balance is a mixture of nuclear in gas and oil and hydro. Excuse me. In Alaska, we're 70% oil and gas, about 20% hydro, and about 10% coal. We also have the resources. We're the envy of the world as far as our coal resources go, because we could supply half the world's need for coal for about 100 years with the resources that we know and some that are hypothetical. One of the hypothetical resources suggests that we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 36 trillion tons of coal in one area of the state. The The resolution was in response also to the fact that the federal government has decided that they don't like coal, and we've got lots of it, and we've got energy problems. And so in the resolution, what I asked for, and I think if you look on line 13 of the second page on the Be It Resolved, it says, be it resolved that the Alaska State Legislature respectfully requests the governor to investigate, without regard to federal permits or restrictions, the development of a mine-mouth coal power plant, of a large coal power plant and associated electrical grids, etc. The operative word there is without regard to federal permits. There's going to come a time, Mr. Chairman, when a natural event, an economic event, war, we're going to wake up and read headlines like we did the day when we woke up in September 11th in 2001 and realized that the world had changed. And when that happens, we're going to have another spike in electricity costs and energy costs here in Alaska that will stagger us and possibly shut our economy down. So my thinking was associated with what I heard a lot of when I was growing up around guys like Joe Vogler and Wally Hickel was the governor at the time back in the late 60s, that if the federal government tried to stop us from doing something, then we should just do it anyway. But the practicality of that really isn't, it isn't practical to consider that in most cases. I think AMWAR comes to mind. Obviously, if we wanted to open up ANWR, which we really should be able to in a regular world, we should be able to go out there and have companies drill and get all that oil. There's something like billions of barrels of oil out there. And we should be able to put it on a pipeline, get it into our pipeline that already exists, and balance our budget with it. But we can't do that because the federal government has said, you didn't say mother may I. Well, to do that, to just say, well, let's ignore the federal government, it's just too complicated. First of all, you've got to find a company that's willing to go out there and break federal law. They're probably not likely to do that because they'll get slammed with fines and God knows what the tax implications might be. And then once you do, you got to get it on a pipeline. There's stream crossings. There's all kinds of things like that. And so you look at what could we do? Well, we can do something on state land. We could build a power plant on state land. And we could build it with our own money. We could contract to have it built. And we don't have to turn it on right away. We can either turn it on or not. And then once we do, we can feed power into the grid system because our people need it. We could even maybe get into the discussion of DC power because we're talking about possibly a couple of gigawatt plant that we would build somewhere near a coal resource. And then if the federal government told us we couldn't do that, well, then we could go through all the lawsuits and all that kind of stuff while we're providing our people power. The way we do it now is we say, gosh, our people need power, and the federal government says, no, we've got these lawyers here on the East Coast, and they have billable hours that they've got to meet with all the NGOs out there, so you just can't do that. Your people don't matter. So the point is that what I would like to do is to investigate the possibility of building a coal power plant on state land, possibly up to 2 gigawatts, without regard to federal permits. You can build it to federal standards. We do. We often do that where we meet all the standards. We provide clean water. We do everything we're supposed to do, but they won't give us a permit, or they will give us a permit. And then one of the guys in the offices down the hall will file suit against us, and it gets stopped for years, and ultimately it just never happens. So, with that said, I notice we don't have a fiscal note from law. And after the last committee hearing, I was talking about the same kinds of things, about challenging the federal government in this resolution. What I would like to know is not only the cost, but I'd like to know the real cost. If we do this, they do that. If they do that, we do this. What's that going to cost? What does that entail? And that comes from really only the Department of Law can answer most of those things. So I would like to, Mr. Chairman, rather than take up the committee's time, I think it's very important that we get what we're trying to do here. Because energy provided a fiscal note, and I really appreciate it. Gene's back in the back room there. But unless you have law and maybe DNR providing fiscal notes and saying what it is they're going to need to do to fulfill the requirements of this resolution, we don't have fiscal notes that accurately reflect what we're trying to do here. So my recommendation, Mr. Chairman, or I would be happy if you would just hear this and hold it, and I'll get some fiscal notes so we can flesh this out a little more.
Okay, thank you. Senator Kelly, is there any committee questions? If not, there are a couple of folks who do want to testify on this, so why don't we go ahead and get their testimony, and then we'll set this bill aside until you get more accurate fiscal notes. Is it Carly Wire?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
We sure can. If you could limit your testimony to just 2 or 3 minutes, we'd sure appreciate it.
Of course. Okay. Well, thank you, Senator Meyer and committee, for this opportunity to comment on this bill. In short, I think it's irresponsible and reckless to fund a study for a coal plant without regard for federal permits or restrictions. Unless I misunderstand the law, it would be impossible to build a coal plant that doesn't meet Clean Air Act or other federal regulations without seceding from the nation. And I think there are better ways to start a dialogue or make a point to the federal government than wasting $75,000 or more with Senator Kelly's new approach to find out what it would cost to enter a legal battle with the federal government on a study for a coal plant that really could never be built without meeting federal regulations and would not even address the needs of our small and diverse rural population. I mean, coal is not simply unfashionable. It's the dirtiest fuel that we have. And we have other options, especially in Alaska. It was not fashion that made us change course and stop using lead in our dishes or mercury to make hats or asbestos and fueling tiles in our schools. It was a new understanding and rational decision-making that changed the way we do things. And it's not just anecdotal observation that shows that we are on this new era of understanding about coal. Global markets are demonstrating that for us. According to a recent article in an investment book, which I would be happy to forward to you, in 2014, the annual energy outlook by the Energy Information Administration increased the number of expected coal-fired power plant retirements significantly. And the reason for this rapid rise in retirements is twofold. First, low natural gas prices and increasing accessibility to the fuel are providing a cheaper and cleaner alternative to coal. And second, the mercury and air toxic standards set to go into effect in April 2015 will require power plants to limit their emissions of toxic air pollutants like mercury, arsenic, and heavy metals, emissions that were previously unregulated. You know, in real time, in the state of Alaska, the state has been spending money studying coal dust in Stewart, and in Fairbanks. The state, the federal government, and residents are struggling to study and clean up both coal ash and air quality resulting from the coal plants that are already online there. The existing coal plant at UAF needs massive state subsidies to upgrade its operation or find a new solution. And so these internal and external costs of coal are not something theoretical used by big green groups in a conspiracy to keep us in the dark or force us to breathe clean air. They're real, and they're happening in Alaska today. So, again, I think SCR 16 is an irresponsible and reckless use of our limited state funds. There's one thing I do agree with Senator Kelly on, and that's that our people do matter. I have friends who are teachers and are facing layoffs and thinking about moving out of state. And I have a lot of friends who live in rural Alaska, and I know this bill would not do anything to address their energy needs. So I ask you to use our limited state funds wisely and stop this bill in this committee. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Carly. Okay, let's get a different perspective here. Lorelei Simon with the Usability Coal Mine. Lorelei, are you with us?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lorelei Simon. I'm the Vice President of External Affairs for Usability Coal Mine. Thank you very much for your time today. As the state of Alaska analyzes a number of energy ideas, I think it's important that we consider their implications. I also hope that the committee will keep in mind that coal has provided reliable, affordable energy to Alaska for 100 years. We're doing it right now. As you look at other options, to possibly meet our future needs, please remember that coal has and will continue to be an important part of Alaska's energy mix. Thank you, Senator Kelly, for introducing this resolution and to the Senate Finance Committee for taking the time to hear not just testimony on the resolution, but as you just heard, testimony on other issues surrounding it. I think I've met with most of you about the McDowell report that came out at the end of last year. It analyzed the energy and economic impacts of coal to interior Alaska. Some of the numbers out of that report I'll give you today. On an energy basis, coal is half the cost of natural gas, one-third the cost of naphtha, and one-sixth the cost of diesel. Without coal on our grid, energy costs in interior Alaska would be significantly higher, perhaps $200 million a year. In addition to energy prices, the McDowell report highlighted the impact that Yosef Valley coal mine has on the region's economy. In 2012, Yosef Valley spent about $72 million with 400 different businesses in Alaska. That's 577 interior jobs and $44 million in annual payroll that are connected to mining, distribution, and consumption of Yosef Valley's coal. So that's just in the interior, but if you look at the statewide impact, it's about 692 jobs and $52 million in payroll. We just heard prior testimony that there is no clean coal and that we need to move towards renewables and technology hasn't kept up, and mentioned a little bit about some federal regulations. But Mr. Chairman, I would just like to take a little bit of time and just make a couple of comments on those matters. At Yosef Valley Coal Mine, we test and analyze the coal in the laboratory year-round. Testing has identified that Yosef Valley coal is among the lowest sulfur coal produced in the world, and even the Environmental Protection Agency has stated that Yosef Valley coal has the lowest sulfur in the nation. These environmental attributes make Huey coal increasingly attractive as an efficient clean energy source. We all know that the world will continue to use coal and other fossil fuels for the foreseeable future. But all sources of energy, including coal, have their weaknesses and their strengths. So it's important that you, as policymakers, invest in all of them so that we have the best energy mix possible. As we continue to invest in renewables and cleaner sources of energy, we certainly need to think about tomorrow and the bridge that is necessary to take us there. Looking forward, we're going to need renewable energy sources to help power our electric grid, but if we ever want renewables to be a viable energy option, we're going to need other sources such as coal, gas, nuclear to get there. The fact is that the renewables' low emissions offsets the CO2 from fossil fuels, but the affordability of coal particularly offsets the very high prices of renewables. The two industries are not adversaries, Mr. Chairman, they're partners. They work together to balance each other's weaknesses so that we can meet Alaska's growing energy needs in a very smart and responsible way. I'm certainly happy to answer questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Well, thank you, Lorelei. I think at this point in time, since the sponsor of the bill wants to hold the bill over, we'll save the questions for another time. But do appreciate your testimony, and it's good, always good to hear both sides of every issue. So, okay, with that then, that's all the public testimony. I believe I have signed up, so we'll close public testimony on this resolution. And Senator Kelly, we'll just wait to hear from you when you want to revisit this topic. Okay, so with that, let's go ahead and get started on the next one, House Bill 23, Kinnick Arm Bridge. I'm going to ask the sponsor of the House bill, Representative Newman, to come forward. I know we've kind of started this bill before and had to stop, but we will be able to get started today, go as far as we can. We'll have floor session in probably 15, 20 minutes. But then tomorrow's meeting, we should have almost all the meeting dedicated to this issue. Representative Newman, if you could put yourself on the record and introduce the do we need a CS before us, or are you going to talk to the CS or to your House bill?
I believe your staff will introduce CS and talk about the changes, Mr.
Okay, so you're just going to give us some general remarks at this time? Okay, go ahead, Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Newman, Representative Mark Newman. I represent the beautiful Susitna River Valley. First, I'd like to thank the many people that have worked on the CS that you're going to see coming forward. Your staff, Senator Meyer, along with the staff of the Governor's Office, to the Commissioner of Revenues and DOT, probably some of the best in the state when it comes to financial and long-term planning for roads. And Mr. Chair, I just want to try and keep it more at 50,000 foot level and let the experts who deal with this every day explain the real dynamics of it. In need, you know, first I want to address the need. Is there a need for a bridge to cross the Kinnick Arm Bridge, or the Kinnick Arm? Absolutely. Currently in Imatsu, we have around 34,000 people a day that travel to Anchorage. That's about a third of our population in Imatsu for a job. Many of those coming from the northern parts of the region where it's a mile or an hour, hour and a half drive to go through there on a good day. You look at the area of growth out there, and before redistricting, we were under about 16,000 last time we did. In this last redistricting, my house district, which includes the Point McKenzie-Kinnick area, was the largest house district in the state with over 32,000 people. That's how fast it's growing out there. I believe that there's some statistics out there that state if the Kinnick area, Point McKenzie area, was a city, it would be one of the fastest, one of the top 50 fastest growing cities in America. That's how fast it's growing there. And Mr. Chair, there's a report that was done, or a news article was done in the Anchorage Daily News a couple weeks ago that talked about home ownership and the ability of Alaskans to try and be able to afford a home and to have a home, and I believe some of that's been passed out to you, and if I may just shortly. It talks about an Anchorage household must earn $100,000 a year to afford an average price home, $65,000 a year for a condo, and $50,000 a year just to rent a two-bedroom apartment. We've got thousands of acres over in Imatsu and good land, and people would like to buy that land and build a home and do a lot of things that I enjoy, quite frankly, as resident out there. Will there be enough traffic over there? Absolutely. I know that there was a report done earlier. It was, in my opinion, a report that was done by a gentleman from outside in Arizona or Colorado or somewhere, and I don't want to get too far down into the weeds on that one. But this has been my backyard for the last 33 years, and I know what goes on in my community, and I know how it's grown, and I know the effects that have happened into our community. I want to address a little bit, what do we do if we don't have opportunities like this into the future? And to me, this has become more of an issue since I've been working on the Health and Social Services budget. And we look at Medicaid growth and some of the dynamics within the state that are, we know, is a defined measurable in our economy. And it was interesting to see the Medicaid growth chart, and it was running at about 5.6% growth, a little bit less than we expected, and that was due to the fact within the last 10 years we've had $2 and $3 billion capital budgets. That's created a lot of jobs in our community. We are now in a situation in this state where we do not have $2 and $3 billion capital budgets. Our ability to put money into capital projects is very limited due to the deficit that we have. What will happen to our state if we do not have projects such as the Kinnick Arm Bridge and other projects statewide, transportation projects, infrastructure projects? What will happen to our communities? This Kinnick Arm Bridge is about $900 million impact, $800 to $900 million impact, direct funding, total funding, which will probably have an economic impact of $5 to $6 billion into our community. And we just heard from some of the prior speakers what happened up in Isabella to try and with some of the impacts and how that affects our communities. And where I get really concerned, again, as somebody has to look at the Health and Social Services budget, is the impacts into our family lives when we don't have those jobs and what effects it will have on the state long term. You know, the pressures that happen to that family unit when they don't have a job, a good job, that pays a decent wage and a salary to afford the homes that I talked about earlier in this article done by ADN, the sexual alcohol abuses, drug abuses that will happen in our communities if we don't have projects like this. It concerns me greatly. A little bit more about the dynamics and the economics. We're fortunate to have Dave Hogan from the, he's on the board of Kubota. He also is a member of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation working on that project. And some of his comments on towards the bridge of how it could impact even the gas pipeline coming across, is that gas pipeline when it crosses Cook Inlet. To be able to suspend that gas pipeline off the Kinnick Arm Bridge as opposed to try and go through Cook Inlet with that, the amount of permits, lawsuits that can happen on that by trying to go through the water there. And so this is how it could affect other projects around the state. We've had a tremendous amount of outpouring of support from our local communities. Many resolutions passed by our local communities and chambers of commerce. Again, Mr. Chair, I don't want to take a little too much time out of the people who've worked very hard on the CS, the experts who know a lot about the financing of this. I'll be open to any questions that the members may have in regards to the need or desires or what is really happening to the communities, and we'll leave the traffic revenues and the financing to the experts. If there's any questions.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Representative Newman. Questions from the committee? Yeah, I think we're pretty familiar with the concept, and I do appreciate your opening remarks there, Representative Newman.
Thank you,
so,
Mr.
Yeah, if you can stay around or your staff in case as we get through the process. Like I said, we'll get more deeply into it tomorrow.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Representative Newman. All right, Suzanne Armstrong, if you could join us, please. I'm going to need a motion, Senator Kelly. To adopt the CS before us?
Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee substitute for HB 23 titled Kinnick Arm Bridge.
Okay. I think that's backslash R. Is that R? Okay.
He just moved in front of me. I'm going to repeat the motion, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me. You think you want to withdraw that? You just moved it out of committee.
Okay. No, I just moved the version.
You moved the...
I'm going to make another motion.
Yeah, make a new motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the Senate Finance Committee substitute for HB 23, the Kinnick Arm Bridge.
Okay, backslash R.
Backslash R.
Okay, very good. So we should have a committee substitute for House Bill 23, Finance, backslash R before us. Any objections? Seeing and hearing none. We have that. So, Suzanne Armstrong, if you could put your name on the record and describe to the committee what the changes are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Suzanne Armstrong, staff to Senator Meyer. The CS that's before the committee is a different approach than previously considered by the legislature as it pertains to financing the Kinnick Arm Crossing. Rightfully, the legislature has been concerned about the state's financial liability for the cost of the project as it was envisioned under a public-private partnership. The work over the interim by the Department of Revenue, the Department of Transportation, the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority, as well as Bond Council, the Department of Law, and the sponsor of HB 23 really focused on looking at alternative finance mechanisms outside of the P3 model. The result of this work was the development of a finance plan that would define the state's financial liability under a straight public finance mechanism. The proposed finance plan includes three components: the award of a TIFIA loan to Kubota, the issuance of state bonds, which is what the CS is focused on, is establishing that framework, and then federal highway receipt authority awarded to the program. If I could point members' attention to a document that is titled Kubota Funding Joint Kubota DOT Proposal March 1st, 2014. It lays out the three components as well as the funding for each of those components.
Okay, hold on just a second. Does everybody have that? Do I have that?
It should be in members' packets, Mr. Chairman. The top points.
Looks like this.
Okay. Go ahead and proceed, Ms. Suzanne.
As I mentioned, Mr. Chairman, the state's financial participation is defined through the issuance of bonds, which are established through the CS before the committee. So, Mr. Chairman, at this time I'd like to walk members through the committee substitute that was adopted, version R, that's before the committee.
Okay, go ahead.
The first five sections of the bill amend current Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority statutes. Section 1 amends existing law to prevent the dissolution of Kabata until bonds issued by the state are satisfied. Section 2 amends existing law to allow Kabata to enter into an agreement with the state to pledge residual toll revenues to pay debt service that is incurred by the state. Section 3 amends existing law to require the state bond committee to evaluate whether toll revenues are adequate for payment of the principal and interest on bonds that have been issued on this issued by the state before Kabata may use additional toll revenue bonds. The existing authority of the of Kabata to issue toll revenue bonds is left in place in statute, and that may be something that the committee may want to discuss as part of this legislation as well. Section 4 amends existing law to require that if Kabata issues bonds in addition to the toll revenue bonds issued by the state, that the trust agreement between Kabata and the state would require the authority to agree to keep tolls at a level sufficient to cover any prior toll revenue pledges made to support the state revenue bonds. Section 5 amends existing law to express the legislature's intent that a toll revenue pledge made by Kabata to support the bonds that are issued by the state is valid and shall give rise to a lien against toll revenues. The remaining sections of the bill establish the framework for issuance of the toll revenue bonds for the toll bridge, Mr. Chairman. Under AS 3715-225 and AS 3715-230, the authorization to issue the bonds is established. Under AS 3715-230 provides a revenue toll bond limit for the total principal amount of revenue bonds may not exceed $300 million. Under AS 3715-235, the toll bridge revenue fund is created. Revenue that's received by the state by contract with the authority from the ownership and the operation of the toll bridge and facilities shall be deposited into the fund. A contract or agreement that's established between the authority and the state may establish priorities for the payment of operations and maintenance by the authority, as well as for the payment of other obligations, including debt obligations of the authority, prior to payments to be made to the state for deposit into this fund. So this envisions, Mr. Chairman, that the authority will pay for the operations and maintenance cost, as well as debt obligations that exist under the award of the TIFIA loan prior to making the debt issuance payments or the debt payments to the state of Alaska. So revenue that's deposited in this fund may be used to pay for principal and interest on the bonds that the state issued, redeem bonds before the fixed maturity date, and subject to appropriation by the legislature for any other purpose for which federal funds may be obligated by the state for under the federal highway program. AS 3715-240 establishes the Toll Bridge Revenue Bond Redemption Fund. Funds that are placed in this account are used to be paid for the principal and interest on the bonds that are issued. AS 3715-245 establishes the bond terms, and AS 3715-250 provides that the bond committee shall authorize the issuance of the bonds by adopting a resolution. AS 3715-255 creates the bond reserve fund. This fund will consist of all proceeds of the bond required to be deposited into the fund, an amount equal to the required debt service as determined by the Commissioner of Revenue, and appropriations that are approved by the legislature. Money in the fund will be applied solely to the payment of the interest and principal on bonds. And bonds may not be issued under a trust agreement, indenture, or bond resolution unless the required debt service reserved for the bonds is in the reserve fund. If the funds in this fund fall below the required debt service, the Commissioner of Revenue will notify the Governor and the Legislature of the amount of funds necessary to restore the account to an amount sufficient to meet the required debt service. The legislature then has the discretion of appropriating funds to replenish the fund to an amount equal to the required debt service. AS 3715-60 pertains to enforcement by the bond owners. AS 3715-265 pertains to amounts required for payment. Starting with the year in which the bonds are issued, the bond committee will certify to the Commissioners of Revenue and to the Commissioner of Administration the amount required for the next two fiscal years to be paid from toll revenues or other state appropriations to the bond redemption fund, which pays the principal and interest on the bonds issued, and to the bond reserve fund, which maintains the required debt service reserve. AS 3715-270 pertains to refunding of the bonds. AS 3715-275 pertains to bonds as legal investments. And the final section of the bill, AS 3715-285, establishes the definition sections for terms that are used in the bill.
Okay, very good. Ms. Armstrong, questions from the committee? Okay, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On section 3, on the first page, it states that the state bond committee to evaluate whether the toll revenues are adequate to pay for the principal and interest on the bonds, and if not, may issue additional toll revenues. But then you get to page 2 on the bond reserve fund. If they can't meet those obligations, there is a provision for appropriation by the legislature. Why do we have to have appropriation by the legislature if to cover those bonds? If in fact, as I read it, section 3 addresses that. So the tolls will be adjusted under section 3, so I don't see why there is a need for the fund to, if they can't meet the obligations, look toward the legislature for additional appropriations. Why have both of them? It seems to me if there are inadequate funds, they issue additional revenue bonds.
Go ahead, Ms. Armstrong.
Through the chairman, Senator Hoffman, it's a good question and one that we actually discussed with legal services as well as with the Department of Revenue about maintaining the authority's ability to issue bonds itself and revenue bonds itself, especially if the legislature decides that this is the direction to go towards in financing a project, that the obligations of the authority need to be met first, the operations and maintenance, the TIFIA payment, as well as the state-issued debt that this bill proposes. That's why I had mentioned in discussing the bill that that's a provision that I think the legislature should have a serious look at and considering.
Senator Huffman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that was the crux of the concern, that the state of Alaska would be on the hook, and it was always portrayed that this was going to be a toll bridge and that would adequately address the construction. And, you know, I think that if that were the case, there would be broad support for the bridge throughout the state if it was going to be a toll. So I just wanted to point that out to the committee.
Great. Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Armstrong, you may not be the person to be asking the question, but you brought the terms up related to what's going on here. And obviously, it's a public policy issue that I have a problem with, where we're dealing with the state revenues going down, and certainly we've got an excellent bond rating, but in 5 years when all our savings are spent and we've maxed up to the hilt with bonding and indebtedness that's out there, that's where I've got problems with that and the other big issues that are out there. In the meantime, we've got the unfunded liability that's got billions of dollars at stake there as well, and we hear a majority of us here at the table went ahead and listened to a presentation the other night that puts these kind of, I don't even know why we're even talking about something like this, that's, you're dealing with millions of dollars that we don't have yet that we're planning on getting with this. But my specific question has to do with TIFIA. You talked about TIFIA right now, or in the when you were just presenting, and can you just update the committee on the efforts to go ahead and secure some of these federal TIFIA loans, keeping in mind that in the recent past, the TIFIA requests have been rejected multiple times?
Yeah, and Suzanne, that may not be a fair question for you. We have the bond experts right behind Ms. Armstrong that I think it might be better addressed.
It could be, and I can certainly hold on that, Mr. Chairman. She brought the term up, but thought, well, I'll give her a chance to, if she can't, then we'll get the experts.
Yeah, you can take a shot at Suzanne. I think her intent was just to introduce the CS and what makes up the various components, and then we got the experts behind her, DOT and revenue and bond council, so...
And at this late hour, it may not even be appropriate to bring them on up here.
Right.
It obviously gets very involved and in-depth. But Maya, like I said, I just was asking her not so much to defend it, but just to kind of see her thoughts.
I too, have questions.
She'd probably be a voter. She'd probably be against it, anyway.
She's can't.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Olson. And we do want to bring up each one of the experts behind Ms. Armstrong there to address, because it's my understanding... If I can, I like to make things simple, Ms. Armstrong, but the funding for this is made up of three components. The TIFIA bonds is about a third, the revenue bonds is about a third, and then the federal highway receipts would make up the other third, with very little GF money anticipated at this time. Is that correct in simple terms, Ms. Armstrong?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct in simple terms, yes.
Okay, very good. Okay, any other questions for Ms. Armstrong? Okay, I believe we have floor session at 11, so it's, although I haven't heard bells, I think it's best, so this looks like a good breaking point, and I apologize for the folks. We got a couple commissioners here and a lot of experts sitting in the audience. Apologize for not getting to you today, but this is basically our only topic tomorrow. We have one quick bill we just got to move out, and then we'll spend the rest of the tomorrow on this particular subject. So with that, we'll stand adjourned until tomorrow at 9 o'clock.